Hello, and welcome to another episode of Show Me Your Titles. I'm Erin Donovan in San Francisco.
And I'm Kathy Dela Cruz in San Diego, California. Today is our Slacker Girls episode. We will be reviewing Smiley Face, Funny Ha Ha, and Daisies. And then at the end of the show, we'll have a special treat, an interview with the director and writer of Funny Ha Ha and actor in it, Andrew Bujalski.
Yeah, man. I mean, what you do is great and all. God bless you for it. But it sounds like plain old market capitalism to me.
It's Reaganomics, trust me.
What about it is Reaganomics? The black market isn't taxed.
Listen, Jane, you're fucking stoned, and I happen to be very knowledgeable about this.
Whoopee! You own a UV lamp. Let's start the revolution.
What the fuck do you know about economics anyway?
Well, I majored in economics in college and graduated fucking summa. I think I know a thing or two about it.
I thought you were an actress.
Economics didn't really work out.
Erin, why don't you get us started with our first film, Smiley Face?
I'd love to. After accidentally eating a dozen of her psycho roommate's pot-laced cupcakes, Jane, played by Anna Faris, has just a few hours to get to an acting audition, raise a few $100s, buy more pot, make more cupcakes, all while stoned like a white balloon. And in the fine tradition of stoner films, nothing is ever that simple. There's an awkward encounter with the cops, a sausage factory, a framed photograph of a corn cob that leads us down a long, winding path, an original manuscript of the Marx Doctrine, and a pot nap that finds our protagonist waking up on an abandoned Ferris wheel. Kathy, how did you enjoy director Greg Araki's wild ride?
I actually really liked it. I watched it with the wrong group of people, unfortunately. I watched it with a group of...
Communists?
Yeah, I watched it with a group of stoners. And I'm... yeah, anyway, the only reason...
Who were fact-checking the whole thing?
Who were fact-checking the entire thing. And it was just... it was really frustrating. Everyone kept... no one was could dispend, you know, belief for a second and say, this is a film. Everyone was too stoned and kept saying things like, that's not how it really is when you're stoned, blah, 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 like completely defeating the purpose. And so, yeah, I enjoyed the film and looked at it as something, as a really interesting addition to the stoner genre.
Yeah, I think this is definitely the portrayal of a stoner from a non-stoner's perspective. Like, I don't think a stoner would willingly be like, yeah, we totally stare off into space and kind of breathe through our mouth a lot of the time. But y'all do that. You really do. Not to say it's not funny. I'm just saying, especially here, I think Anna Faris is amazing in this role. Sometimes unflattering portraits have a little truth to them, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a very unflattering portrait. And that's what I think I found so interesting and that I enjoyed so much was that this is like the first film that's in the quote-unquote stoner genre. I should just not... it actually is a pretty well-fed genre. There's a ton of stoner films out there and have been forever since, like, Cheech and Chong, basically. Anyway, but it's the first one...
And they have, like, you know, points that they all kind of hit on.
Yeah, it's definitely a genre, legitimate genre, as genres go for legitimacy. But it's the first time I've seen it from a female perspective, and I think it was interesting that... It's not only like the first kind of funny stoner film that's really, really a super pathetic portrayal of a stoner, but it's the only one that I can think of that's, you know, about a woman. So it's really interesting that it's both pathetic and female. I just like couldn't help but notice that. And it's really just interesting to me. It's like there are all these films that do really well and are ultra successful, and they're just about idiot guys smoking pot, doing funny things, and going on adventures.
And everything working out in the end.
And everything working out in the end. And here we have a woman who smokes the same amount of pot every day, and her life completely is not working out. So it's just, you know, maybe it's a coincidence that, like, there's some, you know, there actually is some truth into what it's, you know, what this is like. So, Erin, you really don't think that there's anything... I mean, you said it was self-deprecating, but you don't see it go beyond that into, like, pathetic territory?
I think there are aspects of her that are pathetic, but I don't think she's pathetic. I mean, I feel like a good detoxing weekend and this girl could turn her life around pretty easily. She seems really intelligent and, you know, she needs to get that light bill paid. But other than that, I think, like, the sort of darker tone of this film is really more a credit to, I mean, Greg Araki, who, like, is known for these incredibly, well, and earlier in his career was known for these really nihilistic films, and I loved this film Mysterious Skin that he made a few years ago that I wouldn't at all describe as nihilistic, but is extremely dark and depressing.
No, definitely. I mean, there are definitely dark Greg Araki moments in this. You know, the fantasy sequences, obviously. But, yeah, I guess I just couldn't help but watch this and think, like, this was a really sad movie. And that while there were, like, elements of comedy, like, throughout it, like, stitching it together, it was never, like, there was always just this, like, feeling of sadness. Like, even when she interacts with the actor that plays Harold in Harold and Kumar, there's something really sad about that moment, too. Yeah, where it's just, like, this moment where, and I feel like this is going to come up again with our next film that we talk about, where it's, like, this moment where, you know, one person is attracted to the other and then just doesn't act on it, and then the moment's over. It's just, like, it's, like, these moments of, like, not doing what you would like to do, but I just, like, see that through the entire film.
Well, he's attracted to her, and she's the protagonist of this film, so I don't really fault the film for not acting on that. In fact, I feel like we'd probably be sitting here being really critical of it if there was, like, a romantic element to this story.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I didn't want a romantic element at all. I just, and in fact, there was kind of a little bit of a romantic element. Like, there's, you know, kind of an ex-boyfriend who hangs around throughout the film.
Well, and my husband's in this movie.
Is that
John Krasinski?
Is that his?
No, she does have an ex in the beginning of the film.
Okay.
Who actually, I kind of thought was gay, but all right, whatever. But I think it also touches on something, an element of the comedy, actually, that I think works really well in this film, and that is the, like, overwhelming cameos.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Can I just read the list that I was able to make real quick?
Yeah, of course.
Jane Lynch from the Christopher Guest films and 40-Year-Old Virgin, Adam Brody from the OC, Marianne Ross from the Gilmore Girls, not the Gossip Girls, Carrot Top as himself, Brian Posehn from The Sarah Silverman Show, John Cho, as you said, from Harold and Kumar, John Krasinski, my boyfriend from The Office, Danny Trejo, Roscoe Lee Brown, who died shortly after his part in this film, and Dave Allen, the guidance counselor from Freaks and Geeks.
It's true. It's funny because I feel like, just as I feel like this is kind of almost like the anti-stoner film from that genre, I feel like it's like the anti-cameo film as well. None of these cameos feel like what a cameo normally feels like. I feel like I think of cameos and I think of them as kind of like funny and lighthearted, and here everyone, there just is this really this really kind of funny tone throughout the film, and by funny I mean kind of awkward tone, and every cameo feels even just a little floaty, and there's like this sense that like the film is stoned itself, not just the people in it. But the cameos all seem very kind of like slow, and everyone seems a little less glamorous than they normally do. And when you think of cameo,
yeah, can I just say Carrot Top just appears extremely briefly, but it's a very close up, and that guy's had a lot of plastic surgery on his face.
It's true.
That's disturbing.
Yeah. So I mean, It's interesting. I loved Greg Araki's last feature film, Mysterious Skin, and then with this, I enjoyed it. Didn't like it as much as Mysterious Skin, but they are such completely different films.
Yeah.
I really loved the moments that we said were, quote-unquote, very Greg Araki, when there's basically somehow he inserts, like, the idea of skull-fucking into... into the film. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I can't believe I forgot Danny Masterson as the scary psycho roommate who I love. I love that casting because Danny Masterson is a Scientologist, and Scientologists scare the shit out of me.
Do you think that
but
this
yes,
is...
the skull fucking scenes. Oh, dear Lord.
They're pretty amazing. Hey, so, you know, the actor, the lead actress, Anna... I was saying Ferris, but you're saying... What is her last name?
Faris, I think.
Faris, okay. Do you think that this is maybe her most serious role to date?
She is mostly known for the Scary Movie franchise.
Yeah, I almost
feel like...
Which I
think she's been in... She's going to be in the fifth one, but she's been in all of them.
Yeah, I feel... I almost feel like, as far as this genre of film goes, I mean, I'm sorry, as far as this actor, this, like, all of her roles go, this is almost the most serious role she's ever had, where she's not completely just all lighthearted joking around the entire time. It's not one note. She's got some depth, and but again, I can't help but seeing this film as kind of like a sad and pathetic portrayal, and I don't necessarily think that's bad. I mean, we all have a little sad and pathetic in us, and I feel like, and I feel like this film is just kind of, you know, it's showing that a little more. Like, here's a girl, like, in her pajamas all day on the couch, and her life.
Her pajamas are amazing.
And her life isn't perfect, and it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of an interesting film to make. I mean, nothing really happens. It's like girl in her pajamas all day.
Well, and I think she's really, which I love the casting of her in this movie, because I think she really does the broad pratfall type of comedy very well. And I'm sure, you know, I haven't seen the Scary Movies, but I'm sure that she got a lot of practice doing that in those films. Like, I kept watching this film and thinking of, she's like the female Chris Farley. Like, she's just so good at this, like, over the top, but like with a lot of pathos. And there's also like a great tragic undercurrent to all of his like broad comedy. I was thinking of like Black Sheep or something, like, or Tommy Boy even.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've always, yeah, I mean, I've kind of always, you know, bought into that stereotype of, you know, tears of a clown. that the funniest people for a living are the saddest people often in real life. This is just a stereotype. But but I mean, it came across certainly in his performances, and now we're kind of seeing it here. And I feel like Jim Carrey has it going on a lot.
Well, hopefully Anna Faris is not going to die of a drug overdose like before she's 30.
It's true.
Although, did you read that article in Vanity Fair that just came out about female comedians? It's the cover story of the new Vanity Fair.
No, I glanced at it, but I didn't get to read it.
I love that, like, they run this, like, column by, like, professional polemic Christopher Hitchens about how women aren't funny, and then respond, like, everyone has, like, been quoting that article for, like, ever since it came out. I think it was, like, a year ago. And then they have to respond with, like, a cover story. Actually, women are funny. And, like, the story is, like, the worst written thing I've ever read in Vanity Fair. And acts like, oh my god, women started being funny after, like, 1999. And they even make the point of saying, like, oh yeah, well, because of the way Hollywood is structured, like, there just aren't comedies that are centered around women. Like, they're always just this kind of arm candy girlfriend role that are very underwritten. And they talk about how, like, women are really flourishing as comedians on television, especially in cable. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this film was sent straight to DVD. It was financed as a regular film. It went to the festival circuit. It was huge. It got a lot of buzz out of Sundance. It was purchased, I can't remember by who. I want to say MTV, but I don't think that's right. And then just kind of dinked around a lot with the marketing campaign. They pulled back an April 20th release date at the last minute, and then decided, like, almost a year later to just dump it to DVD. It was really reminiscent of I Could Never Be Your Woman, which is another comedy that, I have to say, both of these films look gorgeous, have, like, the most amazing cinematography I feel like I've ever seen, especially in a comedy.
The cinematography is really nice in this film.
It's unbelievable. And they were both about really funny female protagonists, and, like, you're supposed to identify with them, and they are, you know, they're not playing the straight man, necessarily, like, they're actually the funny character in the story. And, like, both films, like, they just, quote-unquote, couldn't figure out how to market them, and so they had to dump them to DVD. And then, so that, like, reflects poorly upon the film, and really, it just reflects poorly upon the distributor to me. I love both of these movies, Smiley Face and I Could Never Be Your Woman.
Which we are not reviewing today. But, it sounds like we're going to launch into a review of it. But, well, here's what I will say about Smiley Face. While I'm sure that articles like the one you're referencing in Vanity Fair do not help the plight of women comedians and marketing those films, I have to say, I just don't think Smiley Face is a comedy. It's really hard for me to see it as a comedy.
What?
I like the film. I enjoyed it, but it in no way really made me laugh too much.
Oh, wow.
yeah, I really took it as kind of a, there were some funny moments, but again, they were all just like laced with like total sadness for me. I just think there's like a real seriousness to Anna Faris' performance here and to the story. It's not that I think the seriousness has anything to do with drugs, because mm-hmm. I don't see a plot about, you know, drug use being bad or wrong or anything, or good or fun, but I just see it as someone who's really not kind of applying their potential and not doing what they want to do with their life, and getting into lots of trouble because of it, and it just doesn't seem like, I don't see it as a comedy.
Like the clip-in we just heard, where she says economics didn't really work out, which I think is actually my favorite punchline of the whole film, even though it's by far not the funniest punchline of the whole film.
Mm-hmm. you know,
I think this film might have actually been crafted just for me. There's so many things in this movie that I was just like, oh my god, I just love that so much, and I always get the sense that nobody else does. Like, for instance, the John Krasinski masturbation scene, holy god, I didn't see that coming, and I was so delighted. I think the whole soundtrack to this film is lifted from the Grand Theft Auto game Vice City, which I play a lot of. And what?
I love that you just admitted to that.
I love Grand Theft Auto. Oh my god, it took me 4 years to conquer that game. I am proud.
You know, we should probably.
But I'm not a pothead. I think I should put that out on the record.
Want to wrap this up soon? And say that, you know, I think that this is more like this smiley face is more like Greg Araki making a stoner film by Greg Araki than it is him making, you know, a stoner film. Like, this is really like a
for the stoner ages. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I have to say, I don't know who the editor was, but I really like the editing here.
I forgot to look, but sure.
And I agree with you. I think the marketing for this film was absolutely terrible. The straight to DVD release never does more
instant fail. Oh my god,
instant fail. It's true. And you know, the cover of this film is kind of terrible, yet it somehow works.
Is it the one where she's hugging the smiley face?
Yeah, it's like she's on top of the smiley face or something.
Okay,
a smiley face is always bad. That's all I'm gonna say.
Even when the film is called Smiley Face.
Yeah, I love that we're going from a film called Smiley Face to a film called Funny Haha.
Are we?
We are.
All right.
So we both recommend Smiley Face, although one of us sees it as a comedy and the other one sees it as a drama. So take what you will from that.
I like Alex.
You mean you like Alex?
Hey, do you want to get something to eat or like get out of here?
No, I am not afraid of getting hurt.
If you weren't afraid, you'd be doing something about this situation.
Well,
we think Alex knows how you feel. You gotta put yourself out on the line.
What is that?
The cow.
Doing what? Peeing? I don't see what that is.
It's not peeing. I found myself a queen. Hello?
Listen, I was talking to my sister. She was trying to encourage you to make a move on me.
I mean, she brought it up.
I love it.
Okay, so next up we have Funny Haha, which I know, judging by the title, sounds like it might be funny, but Smiley Face also sounded like it might be happy. So. But Funny Haha is an independent film from 2002, written and directed by Andrew Bujalski, who also co-stars in the film. Funny Haha is a film about a young woman, played by real-life filmmaker and animator Kate Dolemire, who has just graduated college but can't stop her drinking habits and bad taste in men. She also can't find a permanent job. Sound familiar? The title, Funny Haha, is more about the idea that it would be sad if the situation wasn't kind of so funny. Aaron, what did you think of Funny Haha? I know you just saw it recently for the first time, and it's a film that has kind of made the indie and underground film circles for quite some time now.
Yeah, and actually, I was living in Western Mass when it came out, and it was really huge on the festival circuit out there. And was getting a lot of attention because I think it's set in Boston, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's set in Massachusetts for sure.
You know, a film I kept thinking of while I was watching this actually was Juno. I kept thinking, like, the first 20 minutes of this film I thought were actually unwatchably terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point relegated myself to, I was just going to hate watching this. It was going to be a total chore. And I feel like once I kind of got over myself, I really began to enjoy it. I love this actress. I think she's really good. I actually think everyone in it is amazing. I've never seen so many non-professional actors be so at ease in front of the camera. I love the story. Once it kind of got more kicked into high gear, I think it's really... I just love that this director so wonderfully wrote this storyline that I feel like actually applies to women a little bit older than this character, but this idea that, like, you know, she should stop, like, going after, like, the really handsome jerk who is totally unavailable and go for, like, the guy who's kind of weird but really into her. And it examines, like, actually those guys that are kind of weird but really into you can be, like, even more damaging and psycho than those... than, like, the handsome guys who are just stupid jerks. I love even more that he cast himself in the role of the unlikable dude. I just really like this a lot. Of the mumblecore films I've seen, this is definitely one of the ones I've enjoyed more.
Well, you know, Erin, I agree with you about for, you know, such a large group of non-professional actors, there being so many great performances. And I mean, I think I got to attend a Q&A with the filmmaker, and he was talking about how, you know, it's often a community of people that are all filmmakers and all work together a lot, so they all know each other really well. And then he says what tends to happen is that it's not that people are playing themselves in these parts, but it's that they usually take, like, one characteristic that actually, you know, is true to who they are, and just really kind of, like, exploit that one characteristic.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting to hear him say that and talk about that. And it makes sense. It really does. That, you know, people having to kind of act and play a character pretty similar to themselves would say, hey, you know, what's this one thing I can
It would be incredibly with? Self-conscious. Yeah, I would never put myself in that position.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think the performances are really good. Yeah, Kate is really great. It would be great to see her in another film, you know, doing
And she
acting.
Never, like, she's not really acted again. She's a filmmaker, right?
Well, no, she was in his second film, Mutual Appreciation, but she only kind of has a smaller supporting role in that. But yeah, mm-hmm. she does a lot of her own filmmaking and working on other people's stuff as well.
Well, she's probably happier doing that.
I would assume so. But let's see. I think I agree with you also that the writing is really good here. It has, you know, it has this, like, largely like improvisational feel, but I don't think it is improvised. Like, I think there really are scripts, and you know, it's just, I think there's, like, a certain comfort the characters, the actors seem to have with each other that shows really, you know, that's kind of unique for a film in this day and age. And so I think people assume that it must be improvised because things sound so natural and, you know.
No, I think what this film gets done really, really well is it has great moments.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds like really a slight thing to say, but it's something a lot of films struggle with, is just having, like, these really great resonant moments of truthfulness. And you don't get that through improvisation. You get that through a good script.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I have to say also, you know, the main character in this film is supposed to be, like, 23 years old, I think, just graduated from college. And I have to say, there's something about it, it really feels like this is about a 23-year-old, and that this is about people at this age who are still really young and have just graduated from college. It makes a film like Kicking and Screaming, which is about the same thing in a way, like, mm-hmm. seem ultra slick and polished, and like those folks are completely, completely privileged. And in many ways they are. I mean, a film like Kicking and Screaming is about kids that have just graduated from Vassar, and this is about, you know, kids who seem to have graduated from maybe, you know, not as posh of a school.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's just me. And yeah, you know, I also, there are little things that I love, like, that I agree with you, could have only come from a script, such as the lead character's kind of admiration for her friends who are a couple. Like, I just feel like that's such a, like, young person way of looking at things. Like, oh, that couple, they've got it totally together. Like, they, you know, live in a house and everything's working out for them and blah, blah, blah. But, of course, you have no idea.
But nothing is ever that easy.
Nothing is ever that easy. Yeah, I, I think I understand why people like this film so much, and it's also interesting to me that you know, this filmmaker's first feature film would be about, you know, a strong woman protagonist. Like, not that that's unusual or unheard of. It's just, I think it's interesting. I don't see a lot of like young male directors doing that for their first feature.
Yeah, and she's a great character.
She's a really great character. And I think, you know, in the interview that we'll have at the end of this, I think people will get to hear Andrew talk a little bit about his process of, you know, writing semi-autobiographically through a female character.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that it's shot on film, because I feel like this is a film that could have been easily shot on digital video, but it's not, and I appreciate that.
Why is that, Kathy?
why is that it could have been easily shot?
What does that bring to it that you like so much?
Well, I mean, there's something about, one, I like the look of it. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the most obvious, like, superficial thing to say, but I also like the idea that so much of it does seem improvised, but you know, when you're shooting on film, you don't have time to improvise.
Yeah.
And I think people forget that. I mean, unless you're, you know, a giant filmmaker with tons of money, you don't really have time to waste film stock. So that
I don't think anybody improvises on film.
Yeah. So, I mean, thinking about it from that way really kind of makes you think about things like long takes and moments of kind of, you know, quiet a lot differently, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I think the marketing of this film was kind of amazing. And by marketing, I mean this was totally, like, I feel like a word-of-mouth campaign when it came out.
Can I just get back to the visual thing?
Yeah, of course.
I think the reason I was able to stick with it when I was having a really difficult time with the story at first was because, and God, I almost hate to say this because I am sort of a champion for digital, but I did see that, like, this decision to shoot this on film, I was like, this has to be going somewhere. Like, I've seen so many bad movies that are shot on digital, and you just, like, they never start, they never go anywhere, and it just never seems to end.
Aww. And
especially from the mumblecore genre.
Oh, I'm gonna disagree with you on that for sure.
You don't even know which films I'm talking about.
I don't actually know if you've seen a lot of mumblecore films.
I'm thinking specifically of Frownland. That's how I felt watching Frownland.
Frownland is this, like, random film that I've never heard of. It's probably just, like, fake mumblecore at this point.
Oh my God, it's totally not. It's in the festivals right now, Kathy.
I'm teasing you, but yeah.
All right. It just got a big write-up from Manola Dargis. I think I'm not making this up. But she really enjoyed it. And I feel like a lot of these films, and I feel bad that now Andrew Wajowski's getting lumped into this genre, because I feel like a lot of them are, like, painful on purpose, just out of loathing for the viewer. But, and I feel like if people watch Funny Ha Ha, they might feel that way at first, and that they should just stick it out.
Well, I also want to say that, you know, I think mumblecore is one of those things that I don't think the actual filmmaker or filmmakers in who get lumped into that have really had much say about that. It's kind of like, you know each other, you work together, you know, and so your films have maybe share some similarities, so now they're getting lumped in together, and I think it's kind of unfair to assume that they all enjoy each other's work and support each other's work. You know, it's like, if the media is calling something, you and I should know this best since we were part of the Riot Girl movement back in the day, like, you know, some shitty all-girl band who lived in the same town as us, you know, would get called Riot Girl and, you know, end up getting on the cover of a magazine representing the entire movement, you know? And we knew that, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case or an accurate representation of something. So I think that's probably got to be happening with this, too. I mean, there are way too many things being called mumblecore at this point.
Uh-oh.
I mean, that's just completely what I would imagine, because doesn't that happen to anything that gets a name, like a catchy name or catchphrase?
Well, I do feel like these films have similarities. They're all about young people and how boring they are and how boring their friends are and how they're all really emotional, dysfunctional, and they're all kind of made with this low-budget mentality, and a lot of people are acting and working behind the camera on a lot of other people's films. I don't feel like it's all just, like, everyone's autonomously being lumped in by, like, the mass media.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I see people... I don't know. I can just... I think there are a lot of differences in many of these films. Like, if you watch a film made by the Duplass brothers and then watch a film made by Andrew Bujalski, they're just completely, completely different. They're so different. And they might have a couple of familiar faces in them, but they're such different films.
I'd agree with that.
And so, you know, I have to say, you know, you said something about, you know, this easy trap of shooting on digital video and getting caught, you know, getting into this trap of, you know, nothing happening. There'll be no beginning, no middle, no end. And I mean, I think that's like, I mean, I think it's not just, you know, mumblecore films that might do that. I think there are plenty of films and videos in the world that fall into that trap because everyone's got the technology to shoot on video now.
Yeah, to write a script in a weekend, shoot it on a week, edit it over the weekend, and then put it in a festival.
Yeah, I don't think a film like... I don't think any of Andrew Bujalski's work is like that. I think he takes a lot of time from writing to actually shooting something to actually editing it to, like, putting it out. And so, I don't know. I just think there's a lot more craft that goes into a film like this than it gets credit for.
Yeah. And I think it's telling that didn't he get some sweet Paramount writing job?
I don't actually know about that. I mean, I think you and I maybe read a glimpse of that at some point.
Yeah, I definitely think he got a great writing job with the studio, and I'm glad to see that his writing talent is being noticed by people making films on a much different scale than Funny Haha and Mutual Appreciation.
Yeah, so, well, okay, so moving on to marketing, I just think that since we talk about that this was an extremely successful, like, word-of-mouth campaign that, you know, went through the festival circuit. People were hearing about it, and people wanted to see this. They wanted to see The Puppy Chair by the Duplass brothers. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what's really great is that it seems like, you know, like a lot of these folks in the quote-unquote mumblecore scene have kind of a lack of self-consciousness when it comes to promoting their work, which I think is really great. You know, there's a website for each one of these films, you know, and... there's just, it's like instead of having to dig around through secondary sources, like the distribution company or someone's agent, you can kind of go straight to the filmmaker and get the information that you want on the film and when to see it and when it's going to come out on DVD, things like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of a really cool approach to it all.
Yeah, this generation of filmmakers has definitely been the ones to harness the internet marketing.
Yeah.
For all that it can do. And you know how much I love filmmakers that are also practical at business.
I do, what with your economy background.
And, like, they're not, like, digging themselves a grave, being like, no, you know what? I have to have this Nirvana song in my movie. I cannot move forward without it.
It's true. Erin, I have just a couple more questions for you.
Oh, boy. So
Did you see any similarities between, you know, the lead female character in this film and the lead female character in Smiley Face? Do you see any similarities, like, between the two films? Or are they pretty different?
Well, they're both at a point where they really can't get their shit together. I don't think the lady in Funny Haha is as funny as the lady in Smiley Face. But I apparently thought she was way funnier than you did.
Yeah, I consider Funny Haha a lot more hopeful of a film than Smiley Face.
Poor Anna Faris.
No, I think Anna Faris is great. I mean, I don't think
I mean her character, yeah.
I don't think her character is any reflection on her as a person. I mean, we have no idea what her life is like. I just see Funny Haha as having some hope at the end. Like, you know, the things are going to work out. And I don't necessarily feel that about Smiley Face.
Oh my gosh. Well, I really did enjoy spending time with both of these female lead characters.
So. I'm going to start calling Smiley Face 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 smiley faces.
Why?
I'm just kidding.
It's no country for Smiley Face.
No country. There will be Smiley Face.
There will be pot.
So yeah, just to wrap up Funny Haha, I just want to say that much like another film by this filmmaker, Mutual Appreciation, which came out second after this. I like the way that the filmmaker chooses to end his films. I think endings are, of course, really important, and he does a really good job, I think.
Yes, because as I stated before, some of these mumblecore films don't know when to end.
Oh, I swear you've only seen one, and it was Frownland.
I think I've seen more. I've seen The Great Wall of Sound, which I loved, and I've seen Mutual Appreciation.
I don't even know, is The Great Wall of Sound really mumblecore? I feel like...
It keeps getting lumped in, although it is very different than these two films.
I don't think it is. You've only seen the ones that I've never heard of, basically. I think someone is just trying to trash mumblecore and sending you bad films and with a little mumblecore stamp on them.
Frownland is famous, Kathy. But you shouldn't see it because it's terrible.
All right, okay, enough bashing of a movie I've never heard of. So anyway, Aaron and I both recommend Funny Haha, which is pretty widely available on DVD at this point.
Yes, it is.
And I can totally see it still getting, like, screenings at film festivals, even though it came out several years ago. People love Funny Haha.
Víš co? Když se všechno kazí, tak budeme kažené i my správně vadí.
Aaron, why don't you tell us about our next film?
Daisies is Vera Chitlova's highly experimental film about two teenage girls who decide one day that the world is a terrible, spoiled place, and their only recourse is to, quote, be bad. In the film, we see many scenes of the girls committing light property damage, tricking men into buying them fancy meals, and doing increasingly disgusting things with food. Made in 1966 and financed by the Czechoslovakia government, the film's very odd aesthetics sparked an enormous confrontation between 12 Czech filmmakers and the Ministry of Culture, leaving director Chitlova unable to work for many years, despite the fact that Daisies won numerous awards at very many, many prominent film festivals. Kathy, was this film worth all the trouble?
Yes, yes, it was, Aaron. I love this film. It's such a bizarre film, and it's a kind of strange film to say you enjoy, much like Smiley Face.
What?
I still can't believe it's from the 60s. It's so, it just seems like it's from the future, basically.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't enjoy this film, but if you told me it was made last year, I would absolutely believe it.
Totally. And I can understand why you don't enjoy this film. It's a hard film to watch. It's a hard film to stomach. And I think it's great for many reasons, which I think we'll be talking about. But so why don't you enjoy this film?
I feel like this film is just really a hollow experiment. I feel like experimental film can be really interesting and do things that regular narrative film cannot. But it has to start with a solid idea, and then you can either deconstruct or add on and make it absurd from there, however the filmmaker sees fit. But I just think that Daisies never started out as anything. There's no kernel to hold on to about what this film is, and I feel like, you know, I think the reason a lot of people enjoy this film is because it's so blank. You can really project a lot of your own ideas onto it, but I think within the film there are contradictions for almost any read that you could put on it. And I don't think that's Definitely. Like some super, I don't, like, I just, I look at this film and I don't see intelligence, actually, which pains me mm-hmm. to say, because this filmmaker is really well respected, and I love to think of like a woman in such a male-dominated field in the 60s, no less. But I don't think these films are anything special.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you a little bit about there a certain feeling of hollowness and kind of a blankness where people could project their multiple interpretations onto this film, but then also get each one of those interpretations completely contradicted. I agree with you about that, but I don't agree with you about the lack of intelligence here. I think, I think that it might not necessarily, you know, be about one thing or have this kind of super narrative flow throughout it that is about something that everything else is kind of surrounding. I mean, I think there's definitely an experimentation, not just with the medium of film here, but with also the storytelling. And I do see some intelligence for sure. I mean, I just don't think that there's any way these images could be put next to each other, even from the very beginning of like the opening sequence, where it's like images of like some sort of mechanism turning, and then is it a film camera or is it just some sort of machine?
Oh, I thought it was like a steam engine or something.
Okay, so there's some sort of machine turning, and then it, you know, instantly cutting to, you know, to bombs exploding, to things blowing up, and just that back and forth, like, I think is really, really intelligent. And I mean, I feel like maybe there aren't a ton of like concrete ideas being expressed in this film verbally or through a story, but I feel like just the way that things are put together is really smart to me. Mm-hmm. And I also think, since we did this actually a couple of podcasts ago, I think a really amazing literary accompaniment to this film would be the book Two Serious Ladies by Jane Bowles.
What's that about?
What is that about? Well, Two Serious Ladies is actually a really marvelous book, and it's about two women who kind of basically meet and kind of have this kind of moral disintegration together. And so, you know, I think in Daisy's, it's very much about these kind of two young women who decide that the world is very spoiled and morally corrupt, so that they're going to be those things too, but they kind of face resistance from this world that doesn't like to see women acting that way, which actually, to me, makes me think about something completely off subject. It's seriously that kind of attitude that I feel like I see expressed in this film completely reminds me of today,
celebrity culture.
Pop culture's like response to women like Britney Spears and Anna Nicole Smith. Mm-hmm. I know that seems really absurd. But,
In fact, there's even a scene where, like, they are going around committing trouble and everyone's ignoring them, and they say, it really makes me, like, one of them says, it makes me so uncomfortable when people aren't looking at us.
Yeah, totally, totally. I mean, I definitely feel that, like, right now, and this film was made in, like, 66, and it's 2008, and, you know, I actually was just, I wrote something recently, about the way that everyone loves, like, James Dean River Heath Phoenix Ledger. And Heath Ledger, all these young men that kind of died at their own hands, but they died beautiful and young, and so everyone thinks of them in this special way. But then when we watch women like Anna Nicole Smith or Britney Spears, who are like these kind of time bombs, and everyone is watching it happen and taking photos, but no one's doing anything about it. Like, I see this kind of, like, no one wants to care about these women because they're, like, used up already or something by this society. We can cut this out. But anyway.
No, it's just sad.
But I just feel that way. It's like, you know, no one cares about these women once they've, quote unquote, gone bad, which is something that actually keeps verbally coming up in Daisy's. Mm-hmm. They keep saying, we've gone bad, this is why this is happening.
Yeah.
Erin, I feel like I've just made you really...
And then they go home and cut up some bananas and sausages with scissors and really gross me out.
Yes, yes, it's true. That doesn't gross me out at all. But I mean, so there's very much this thing in Daisy's where, you know, they... I feel like it's as simple as they consume the world before it consumes them. I feel like that's very much what's happening in this film. And, you know, and I feel like, and we see that throughout kind of played out with food in this film, which I think is really kind of fabulous.
Yeah, actually, I do love movies where girls are eating really ravenously. Can I go back to the point you were making about celebrity culture?
Yeah, yeah.
Because actually, I was reminded while I was watching this, I'm going to make an even further tangential connection of a book review I read of the Gossip Girl series in The New Yorker recently, where they talk about, I don't know if you've read the books or seen the TV show.
No.
But there's this character in it, her name is Blair Waldorf, and she's like the bad girl of the show. And the reviewer was pointing out, like, she's really like this extremely compelling villain, because to the adult world, she is... and even to, like, other students in a lot of ways. She's this very docile, pleasant child. Like, she's very well-behaved. She gets good grades. She, you know, is always well-groomed or whatever. But she just has so much hatred and loathing and just a lot of animosity towards the world, but she completely turns it inward. Like, she has all these problems with self-esteem, and she's bulimic, and she has a lot of sexual dysfunctional issues. And I just thought it was really interesting that Blair Waldorf is, like, beloved among, like, the same group of people who just probably spend a lot of time on the internet calling Britney Spears fat or something.
Totally.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like this movie just reminds me so much of a lot of, like, the Brooklyn art scene. Maybe this isn't a fair thing to say, but I feel like I hear this film cited as an influence for just a lot of shallow artists, and I can't hold that against the film because it's not their fault, but, like, I just, yeah, I have a hard time connecting this material with, like, a larger effective message.
You should read Two Serious Ladies and then come back to this film.
That book sounds old.
It is old, but it's pretty amazing. And again,
well, let me say some nice things now because I feel bad because I've just been bagging on this film. Okay. I did see three moments where I thought that this film was obviously hugely influential to films that I have, if not loved, at least enjoyed watching since. There's, she has a great use of music. Like, just the sound juxtaposition between what you're seeing on screen and, like, how horrifying it is, and then she'll play, like, a beautiful piece of classical music or opera. Like, I think that is extremely, and she came before Kubrick, so I can't help but think that she had a little bit of influence on Stanley Kubrick. And then there's a little bit in her bio about how she has maybe, like, a very friendly competition with Miloš Forman, who's another Czechoslovakian filmmaker who got ousted during this time and couldn't make films, and he ended up coming to America. There's a scene where, at the very end, the girls are destroying a banquet table, and it's, I think, like, lifted directly and put into Hair, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, where Treat Williams is walking down the table during a very fancy party. And then there was another scene where the girls steal corn from a farmer, and the farmer kind of chases them off his land. And that scene is in Barbette Schroeder. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
His film Barfly, about Charles Bukowski. So even though I feel like I didn't enjoy this film very much, and I enjoy Vera Chetlova's other films even less, I do think that she's been an important filmmaker in terms of history. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think this is a terrible film to watch in terms of, you know, important films in film history. This is the second time I've seen it. I've just never really enjoyed it.
Well, I think those are all really great points, and I appreciate them, Erin.
Awesome.
What if I was like, but, ..
But you still suck because you don't like Daisies.
No, what I just want to say is I think that, you know, we reviewed this today under Slacker Girls with these other two films that are very, that I feel like have a lot more in common with each other than this one does with them. But what I like here is that it's different from those two films that we talked about earlier in many ways. But one big one to me is how these women kind of keep going and don't give up. They may not be on the best path by any means, but they don't stop. And so I feel like, you know, it's kind of like, it's like the system has failed them and they've turned bad. That's their words, not mine. You know, but they keep on.
Yeah, again, though, don't you think there's something in the film that kind of contradicts that, though, Kathy?
Well, there's something in the film that contradicts everything. So, okay. I mean, there are definitely points when they're just like, they're like, we've gone bad, like, we're gonna die or something. I don't know, but.
Well, I mean, can I spoil the film?
Sure. I don't think there's a way to spoil the film.
Well, they die at the end, don't they? They get crushed.
You know, that crushing scene at the end is really, I think, just another thing open to interpretation. Like, it's really hard for me to feel like these were ever two real people exactly,
yeah,
and that this is our reality. So when the chandelier is coming, it's like this explosion. I mean, they also cut themselves up, like, at a point. Like, they decapitate each other and are still walking around. So I feel like to say that like, physically die in that final scene is, like,
that's actually a great scene.
Is you know, it's hard for me to say that one is you know, real death in
but
this
film.
But
they have this moment where they feel like, oh, no, we've done something really horrible, and then they try to fix it, and then I feel like they die. I don't know. And then, like, the end, the title card at the end of the film is, this film is dedicated to all the, I'm paraphrasing, but all the people who think that the worst thing that can happen in the world is a messed up trifle.
Yes.
I feel like that kind of undermines the message of, oh, like, consumerism is terrible.
Well, I mean, I feel like the whole thing is really sarcastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to say this would be a good film to watch with that Italian film, like, Le Grand Bouffe, where the, I can't remember who made that.
Oh, where they eat themselves to death?
Yeah, where they just a bunch of, like, kind of upper-class men decide they're going to kill themselves by feasting on amazing food and wine and sex with prostitutes for a weekend, and that's how they're going to kill themselves. And then at first it's like the most fun thing they could ever do because it's total like bourgeois indulgence times 1,000. And then the actual physical reality of eating yourself until you implode is like the most disgusting thing ever.
It really is. These are the two movies you should watch if you are anorexic and need inspiration.
And I just have a few more things to say.
Hit me.
I love women's relationship to food in both Smiley Face and Daisies. Because I feel like neither ever go into, like, what's expected of, like, females and food in film or in media. They never talk about body image. It's like, food is
either...
And they're
not eating emotionally. I feel like that's something I just hate seeing in films.
Yeah,
like
they're
a woman
either
crying and eating donuts at the same time or something.
Yeah, in both these films, food is either subversive or political or both, but it's never about physical hunger.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, I know we're going to have to wrap it up soon because this is the longest podcast ever. But, you know, I watched this film and I see so many different things that either came before or after. But I just see this film completely influenced by, like, Maya Deren, by Fellini, by Ingmar Bergman, by, like, Godard, by influenced. I see influence of this film in later films by, like, the animator Jan Svankmajer. I see so much taken from silent film, classic silent films in this film, which I think is really, I understand why it constantly gets like a feminist interpretation and reading. And I think it's because, you know, they kind of subvert like the idea of like silent comedy a lot and taking those silent women and then having them, you know, literally deconstruct the world around them and actually cut up the world around them and themselves. And, yeah, I feel like all three films we've reviewed today are kind of like, they represent slightly unconventional women, even though they're not really that unconventional. It's just that we don't see them on screen that often.
Yeah, unconventional in film, maybe.
Yeah, totally. And again, similar to a film we did last week, but very different, I love the idea of two female friends kind of being the center relationship in the film.
But don't they hate each other?
Well, I mean,
I mean, it's hard to say because there's nothing really concrete in this film, but I feel like they don't like each other.
I mean, I don't feel that they necessarily don't like each other. I mean, Aaron, it's so, yeah, I agree with you. It's really kind of, this film is like, I think this film is like amazing, but also ridiculous. So, I mean, they're both named Marie, and I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people who think they're the same person even, you know, just like different.
Oh my God, can I just say, I saw two films this week where there were two women as the protagonists and they were both named Maria. And that was amazing. The other one was Viva Maria and it was incredible. Can I just go on a riff here?
Yes.
It starred Brigitte Bardot and Jeanne Moreau and it's directed by Louis Malle and it's about a group of circus performers who decide to fight in the French Revolution. It's incredible.
This riff is going to go on forever because Louis Malle said one of my favorite quotes ever that I think is really appropriate for Daisies.
What?
He said at some point that he felt, and I'm going to slaughter this quote, he felt like that young girls were basically like the smartest people in the entire world, but that through school and like the culture they get exposed to, they're basically untaught everything as they get older, because everyone is like afraid of these smart young women. And I feel like I totally feel that in Daisies, kind of like this bit of like unraveling of these know-it-all girls, but I mean that in the best sense and the worst sense. But we didn't talk at all about something that's really important. And like, the technical, like, kind of astoundingness in Daisies. It's, I mean, everything is pretty amazing. The cinematography is kind of phenomenal. The sounds that the filmmaker puts in are both, like, experimental and kind of, like, dazzling for me.
Yeah, well, it's entirely shot without sync sound, right?
I guess it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it all sounds dubbed to me. So, yeah, the filmmaker got pretty wild with the sound.
She did, but it totally works. And I think the editing is really, really fabulous, too. And I think she had a female editor.
And the rainbow? I wanted to ask you, actually, how do they do the rainbow thing with the film? Because I love that, and they should put that in every movie.
I don't know which rainbow thing you're referring to.
I'm talking about where, like, the screen goes from being a color picture to all red, to all yellow, to all blue, to all purple.
Oh, I think that's either, I mean, they either did it while they were shooting and put, like a filter, or they just changed it in post-production with, like, you know, with using, like,
before digital.
Yeah, but you could do that with an optical printer and color film and using, like, a certain filter.
That should be in every movie.
And
welcome to Aaron's film school. Every film should have a rainbow scene.
Yeah, I think I just want to end on this note where I think
Aaron's film school.
I want to end on Aaron film school note.
Class,
no,
I just dismissed. Want to
end on I you know, this film, it actually says on the cover, like, a madcap feminist farce. And I think I think a lot of that comes from, you know, a belief that, you know, you can't necessarily show, like one, there isn't, like, one uniformed, like, women's experience that can be shown on film.
Yeah.
But you can always construct and deconstruct different visions and versions of that experience. And I think that's why this film doesn't necessarily succeed at being a quote-unquote feminist farce, although farce might be accurate.
Yeah, but, I'm with you on farce.
Yeah, but I feel like it's definitely pretty important to the history of cinema. And anyone, it's really funny, Aaron, because I have read a couple of reviews where people are like, I can completely understand why anyone who ever identified as Riot Girl or a hipster feminist would like this movie.
Oh my God.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I'm depressed.
It's like, this film is a little bit more of, I love this film, but I agree, there's a lot of style, not a whole lot of substance, but I still appreciate this film.
There's also, like, I feel like the characters are just so unlikable that it just pains me to see this called a feminist movie, because I feel like they don't like each other, and they're not doing anything but destroying the world around them.
Okay, and I kind of disagree with you with the dislike each other, because I think they borderline on flirtatious with each other throughout the film.
Yeah. There's some of that, too. This movie's crazy.
I mean, when they're rolling around in their underwear, like, wrapping each other up in blankets, and then...
Oh, yeah. That's a little gay.
A little gay. But I think, I mean, they're also, like, I mean, this film is made at a time when, like, Godard is, you know, making his Here's a Beautiful Woman in Her Underwear, like, movies. And I think there's kind of, like, a response to that. It's kind of like when you've got, like, some misogynistic hip-hop song, and so a lady rapper, like, does her response to it.
Yeah.
I feel like I see some of that in this film.
Except her response was crazy. It would be like a Courtney Love responded. And let me
Okay.
I want to just add one more thing that I really do actually like about Daisies, and that is the DVD has this wonderful... a lot of the correspondence between the Ministry of Culture and Ms. Chetlova when she was trying to get some credentials so you could be a filmmaker again. Just going back and forth between this guy from the department, like, telling her why her films aren't adding to the value of, like, their good socialist nation, and then her trying to respond, like, why her films do have good socialist values. And it's just, like, this really remarkable slice of history. And I think, actually, a lot of those letters are available online. I really recommend just reading that, because it's very interesting.
Okay, so now that we've talked about Daisies, we're going to change pace in a big way here and go to an interview I did a few weeks ago with filmmaker, writer, and co-star of Funny Ha Ha and many other things, Andrew Bujalski. He visited San Diego a few weeks ago, and I was able to get this amazing interview with him. So check it out, please.
I'm Kathy Dela Cruz from Show Me Your Titles, and I'm here with Andrew Bujalski. Mm-hmm.
I said your name, right?
That sounded, you did say my name.
Okay, good, good. As many of you know, Andrew is the writer and director of Funny Haha Mutual Appreciation, and I'm sure many short films I haven't seen.
Not many.
I just imagine that there would be. And I am lucky enough to be able to ask Andrew a few questions for Show Me Your Titles. So, Andrew, I've read that you've worked with Chantal Ackerman. She's kind of one of my heroes. I just wonder what that experience was like.
Chantal was my thesis advisor when I was in undergrad at Harvard. And it was great. I mean, I was, you know, 20 or 21 years old. And I love her so much personally that it's difficult. Partially, it was a long time ago, but you know, when I think back, you know, and that kind of situation, like thesis advisor situation, it's a little more to do. You're not necessarily sitting at the feet of the master observer. I mean, it is a little like any kind of mentoring situation like that. I come in with my work, and she tells me what she thinks, and we talk, and so it was very pragmatic, and for better or worse, it was more focused on her trying to help me with what I was doing, as opposed to, I mean, in a way, it might have been a more profound experience for me to get to watch her do her work.
Definitely.
But I was crazy about Chantal, and certainly, I mean, in a way, it was also, yeah, she was a great thesis advisor. It was also kind of the first time I got to be that close to somebody who was a real, you know, living, breathing artiste, and just someone with this kind of lifestyle that, not that it's so exotic, but there is something when you're, you know, a kid from the suburbs, in the States to meet, you know, a real European artist and see them in action is a powerful thing.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you. Did Chantal, since she worked with you or you worked with her a couple of years before you made your first feature, did she get to see your two features and mm-hmm. did you talk to her about them? And
we didn't, let's see. I mean, you know, she lives in Paris and we're not in constant contact, but I've sent her both the films and, you know, she's said kind words about them. We never had an in-depth conversation about them.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just a big fan of her.
Yeah, no, she's amazing.
And my last Chantal question is, I think it's really great and interesting that your first feature, had a strong female protagonist. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if working with Chantal, just because she's such a big influence on both women and male filmmakers, but she was definitely kind of also a big influence as far as like feminist cinema mm-hmm. goes. So I just wonder if you think she influenced, you know, this kind of semi-autobiographicalness, but through a female protagonist in Funny Haha at all.
It's hard to say. I mean, I wouldn't be able to point to any kind of specific influence there, but certainly, I mean, as you say, you kind of pegged it there. That I think for me writing Funny Haha, you know, it's not, clearly it's not on some level autobiographical, but it is very personal, and I was filtering a lot of my own experience and emotions through this female character, and I found that really helped me in writing it, just to put that half step of distance between myself as myself and this character to for there to be a necessary foreignness to the character being female. It took me out of the kind of worst aspects of autobiography. I mean, if you're writing about a character where it's not exactly clear what the difference between yourself and the character is, at least for someone like me, it can kind of turn into very, very poor therapy quickly, you know, and you sort of, you're pouring all of your self-loathing into the character. And so I found that, you know, by writing a female character just made my writing much better, at least at that time.
Wow, great. Thank you.
Okay, so completely different subject. Can you tell me what People's House is? That I kept seeing that, but I have no idea what it is.
It's a little short we did for the Mutual Appreciation DVD. When it came time to put together a DVD of the film, I like the idea. I really like DVD extras. I don't. I'm a really compulsive person. I don't like to watch movies on DVD. I really like to go see things theatrically, and I've been very lucky to, the last few years, I've been living in Boston, which is also where I grew up and where I went to school. There's a lot of great repertory theaters around there, and so I try to see things on the screen as often as possible. So most of my experience of DVDs is not watching movies, but just like obsessively watching the extras, and I like it when people do things that are different or add in some way. I definitely didn't want to do the kind of path of least resistance and do, you know, me talking through scene after scene or making of kind of stuff. I don't like that stuff. So what we came up with instead was we did a little 8-minute short, which followed. It took two of the supporting characters from the film, Alan's dad in the film, and Walter, the music industry exec that they have the party with in the film, because these guys in the film had had an off-screen relationship, which was kind of always a little mysterious. There was always, because the dad hooks up his son with this kind of moderately sleazy industry guy, and it's always. It's always a little that relation, just because they're from such different worlds. That was always kind of a question mark in the film. So I thought it'd be fun to get those two characters together. I also, just knowing those two actors, I thought it would be fun to get them together and see what happened. So we just made a very kind of lightweight 8-minute short that it's just the two of them hanging out. And in a weird way, I like the oddity of it too, because in some ways it's like. It's kind of like a miniature sequel, in as much as it seems to take place after the movie, and but in other ways is, you know, I mean, it doesn't pick up any particular narrative threads from the film, and we shot it on video and it's in color, so it feels different from the film. It was basically an experiment and a kind of fun lark.
That's great. Did you shoot it? I'm sorry if you just said that. Did you shoot it on film also?
Or? No. Yeah. The short we shot on video, and that was also. My real kind of entree into that world, because the features we've been doing on 16mm, and that's something that I've been pretty adamant about. But I like the idea of, well, here's a chance for me to, you know, catch up with the late 20th century at least, and cut it on video, and which I, you know, I've been cutting my film stuff. I've been cutting on film. So it was just an experiment all around.
Did you like the experiment of?
Yeah, I did and I didn't. I mean, the convenience is pretty amazing. We shot it over a weekend. We shot it Saturday and Sunday. On Monday, spent most of the day returning equipment, and I drove from Boston to New York. And then on Tuesday, I had a rough cut, and that's amazing.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a kind of small film, and it wasn't a terrifically challenging edit, but still, just that. I mean, that's a stunning speed, especially given that I'm still. You know, technologically, I'm still kind of in the, I don't know, 70s. I still cut on a Steenbeck. I'm cutting a new feature on a Steenbeck right now, and it's slow going. And certainly on this new film, more than in the past, I've had a little bit of a feeling of this is really slow. and I don't mind. I mean, obviously, I care about, you know, the finished product is what matters to me. But I've had more speed envy than I used to.
Wow, I don't think I realized that you were cutting your feature films on a Steenbeck.
Yeah.
That's great. I don't know many feature filmmakers who are still doing that.
Neither do I. You hear people, I heard somebody says, like, you know, that like Spielberg loves films, just Spielberg always does a cut on a Steenbeck. But I feel like that, I don't believe it. I mean, I don't know how it works, but I imagine even if he does have somebody cutting on a flatbed, he can also have like 20 people doing alternate cuts on video. I don't know. I know that in Boston, where I live, Fred Wiseman, the great documentary filmmaker, he still cuts on flatbed, because the guy that I go to for material, you know, just the splicing tape and all that. I'm always kind of hearing about Wiseman stuff via him. I mean, his clients now are the schools and Fred and me and a couple other weirdos.
Wow. Yeah, I feel like I know people working in shorter film formats, you know, still cutting film, but not features. Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
I like the tactility of it. I like the feeling of it. Obviously, there are things... The sound mix, and I make things difficult for myself because I am cutting mag sound, but then I dump that all back into the digital world to do the sound mix, because I think that's one area in which I feel like the advantages of working digitally are kind of so clearly, you're so clearly superior, just the flexibility you have there. I don't think that video editing is superior in any way except that it's faster.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. I'm a film enthusiast as well. I love Super 8 film, and was so crushed when they discontinued Kodachrome.
Yeah, sure.
And I still think about it a lot. My last film was actually shot all in Kodachrome Super 8, and it's just, I feel like that's just like the end of it, like that film, and yeah. It's really sad, but not about me.
I'm going to have the Paul Simon song stuck in my head the rest of the day.
Which Paul Simon song?
Kodachrome.
I don't think I know that.
Oh, it's great. You had me this close to singing it for you, but I'm not going to do it.
Well, maybe at the end of this you'll feel like it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. So did you not record commentary for either of your DVD releases?
No, I didn't. But we did do, you know, the Funny Haha DVD. We did. I got a friend of mine who was a Russian. She's from Russia, and she was studying Russian literature. And I had her record a commentary just because I'd had conversations with her about the film, in which her view on it was so, you know, it was 180 degrees from anything I heard from anybody else about the film, and I loved listening to her view on the film, and I thought it'd be fun to have her do the commentary just because it was going to be, you know, out of left field, and she did a great. I mean, she took it really seriously. When I initially proposed it to her, I said, you know, don't worry about preparing anything. We'll go into the studio and you just talk about the film the way that you've talked to me about it, and I'm sure it'll be great. But she was much too thorough, and she said, no, I have to prepare something. And so she just wrote up this, basically a long essay on the film, and I was so happy to have her do that. It's certainly a challenging commentary, but I don't, you know, it's always been unclear to me who actually listens to DVD commentaries anyway. Yep. And then for Mutual, we did another, again, trying to get a perspective that wasn't going to just be me saying, okay, well, you know, we use this lens here. So we asked, and it seemed somehow fitting with some of the themes in the film, we asked parents of those of us who worked on the film, cast and crew, the core cast and crew, we asked around, and you know, not everybody wanted to do it, but we got a group of parents together, not all in one sitting. It's broken up into chunks, so I think I forget now. I think there's like 15 or so different chunks of so for, you know, 5 to 10 minutes at a time, you'll hear one set of parents talking about that section of the film, and we're pretty loose with that. I mean, obviously some people wanted specific guidance, but we tried to give them as little of that as possible. I mean, I think we fed them some sort of notions, but in general, we wanted to leave it as open as possible and see what happened. And it's funny to me. I mean, again, it's something that, you know, maybe it's hard to listen to 2 hours of it in one sitting, but I think that there's certainly some kind of gems and sparkling moments. And what's great is there's also just a wide variety of opinion. There are plenty of parents who are not at all afraid to bag on the film, which is something, you know, it's fun for me to listen to.
That's great. That's a pretty brilliant idea for a film commentary.
Oh, thank you very much.
The only commentary I can think of watching is The End of Three Women by Robert Altman. Yeah. I just was so speechless with the ending that I was like, that's the one part I just need to hear what he has to say about that. And it almost made it more bizarre hearing him talk uh-huh. through the ending. It almost made it more confusing. Have you seen that film?
I'm just ashamed to say I've never seen it.
I don't know. You should maybe check it out.
No, I'd love to. But yeah. This is where I have my compulsive thing. It's like if it, and I've missed it before, but, you know, if it shows up at some kind of repertory theater somewhere, I'll be there. But I avoid getting the DVD for fear that it will show up somewhere and I'll regret not seeing it on the screen.
Definitely. So you mentioned that you currently live in Boston, but mm-hmm. I know that you've also lived in Los Angeles and Austin.
Yeah, and I'm moving to Austin again on Saturday.
In your opinion, what's been the best city for you to be a filmmaker in?
I couldn't really parse it out like that. I mean, we've made, you know, the two features that are finished, and then we shot a new one over the summer that I'm editing. And we shot the first one in Boston, we shot the second one in New York, we shot the last one in Austin. And we've really been very fortunate in every city. I mean, in terms of finding people, people have been willing to help and willing to contribute. I've never made a film in L.A., so I don't know what that's like. I would imagine, certainly get the impression that it's more difficult at this level. I mean, if you're making a film in L.A. for... You know, maybe if you're making a film for $1 million or more, maybe it's easier there because there are certain resources in place. But if you're under that level, it's going to be harder to get just that kind of goodwill whipped up around you. On the other hand, maybe not, because there are so many people there who are hungry and wanting to work. I've never done it, but I've tried to. The way that I've worked has been, you're always tapping into a community, but you're also always kind of on your own. You know, your own engine is at the heart of the thing. So you'd like to think I could do it anywhere. Although that's probably not. I mean, you need some semblance of community there, just to at the baseline.
Yeah, I'd love to see you make a film in my hometown of San Antonio, Texas.
Right. Well, hop, skip, and a jump from Austin.
I was just curious about, you know, a community of filmmakers, but it sounds like you've been able to find them in everywhere that you've lived.
Yeah, and we make the film small enough that on the last film, for better or worse, and there certainly were some disadvantages to it, but it wasn't necessarily planned this way, but it ended up being that we were imported a lot of people to Austin on the last film, not because there's any lack of talented or enthusiastic people in Austin. In fact, there's a surplus of them, but just because these were people I'd worked with in the past, and there's some kind of community already formed. So of an 8-person crew, you know, I think 8-person day-to-day crew, there's one native Austinite on that crew, and of the cast, you know, our three major players were also people that we brought in. But still, I mean. Still, we're plugging into the community a lot, and it helped a lot that I had lived there in the past. I mean, a lot of the kind of favors and help we were getting were from these sort of long-standing relationships.
Can you tell us a little bit about your next project?
I can't tell you much just because I'm not good at talking totally. About it. The methodology was similar to the first two films. I wanted to make another small film. I wanted to make another film where there were more questions than answers going into it. Partially because I just didn't. It's a way of working that was probably easier and more sensible when you are in your 20s, and which at this point none of us working on the film are anymore. So I kind of wanted to just do one while it still seemed possible to do it this way. It's about a pair of twin sisters, and that's all I know to say right now. I'm editing it and I just recently got as far as a very, very rough assemblage, and there's a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of ways in which I kind of feel like I haven't, still don't know, you know, still haven't figured out exactly what it is or how to make it work, and, you know, you just kind of keep... day by day chipping away at it and trying to find the heartbeat.
I think that's really great. The not exactly, you know, knowing what the film is about, but making it,
scary, and it's also, you know, I fear over romanticizing that in a way. I mean, I think that there's a way in which as I get older and have done this a few times, you know how like sometimes the people who are the kind of craziest radicals in their youth like get violently conservative as they get older. Yes. I can like feel myself on the precipice of that in a way. There's a part of me that having worked this way now and seeing more and more kind of you know, people younger than me jumping in with similar philosophies, sometimes with great results, sometimes with not great results, there's a part of me that starts to long for, like, you know, it's a little nuts, and I don't really think this yet, but there's part of me that kind of feels like, well, maybe after college I just should have, like, gone to LA and tried to be, like, a sitcom writer or something and had this life, which I would have hated, but I think that, you know, there is something to be said for kind of dues paying, not in the sense of, not socially, but in the sense of just getting out there and trying things and seeing what works and being in that kind of pressure cooker. And because I think that, you know, when you look at a lot of the filmmakers that I admire are, I mean, you know, Chantal Ackerman, someone who's not like this at all, who was just kind of, well, I don't know her full biography, but you know, she made this short film when she was 18, and I mean, she just kind of burst into being, and she was like fully formed great artist. But a lot of the people I admire are not like that. And you know, these are people who like do work in the industry for 10, 15, 20 years, and then kind of like find their voice. But the voice has also been honed by actually being in the thick of it, as opposed to kind of above it as. And I guess I sort of came to it from above it, you know, which there's advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, that made me think of two things. On our podcast in the last couple of episodes, at some point we reviewed a couple of films by much older filmmakers who'd been working in the system, in the Hollywood industry, the system, mm-hmm. forever. And now, many years later, we're kind of experimenting more. And mm-hmm. it wasn't necessarily always succeeding, but it was really interesting to see it happen. Like, and this is not the best example, but maybe it is. Did you see the Francis Ford Coppola film?
That movie's crazy.
It's the craziest movie ever. But at the same time, it was kind of, it was almost kind of refreshing that was like his comeback, this completely crazy thing. Mm-hmm. And then also I was thinking of Sidney Lumet with,
right.
I actually liked that film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, but he's like in his 80s,
yeah.
isn't he? And
yeah.
I thought that was, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead was more interesting and took more risk than a lot of films by, filmmakers last year. That was just a little rant.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you have any. Anyway, I just felt like that was something. I don't know. Also, you're really working with twins, or you worked with twins?
Yeah, real twins. Yeah,
that's great. We also did an episode on sisters in film, and we had a really hard time finding films about sisters made by women.
Hmm.
It was a really
interesting.
It was a really interesting thing. It was really hard for us to find things, and yeah. So I don't know. Maybe we're just not doing good enough research, but but also we reviewed two twin movies, Brian De Palma's Sisters,
yeah, sure.
which I'm going to guess that your film's nothing like.
Not much.
And then one of the craziest films of last year, which was I Know Who Killed Me with Lindsay Lohan.
I haven't seen it. I keep hearing about how amazing it is.
So I guess when I start talking about Lindsay Lohan, it's probably time to go. Thank you so much, Andrew, for this interview.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I look forward to your next film, whatever it may be called or about.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Jolly ho. Good interview, Kathy.
Why, thank you, Aaron. It was a pleasure.
It's so interesting that he has that the same issue about seeing films in theaters that makes him unable to watch them on DVD. I was listening to an interview with Julie Delpy, and she said she had the exact same thing. Like, there's tons of great movies that she wants to see, but she has, like, a complex and doesn't want to watch them on DVD.
I can completely understand that. It's actually, it's really hard for me to hold my attention, perhaps you've noticed. It's really hard for me to hold my attention on watching something on a small screen. I just get distracted and I'm like, oh, I could be multitasking right now. And the only
yeah.
time I feel like I can't be multitasking is when I'm in a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then I
wonder, like, cause he's from Boston, if that's like hard to maintain.
No, I mean,
somewhere where I don't see as being a film capital.
No, I mean, I think they have really good repertory theaters, there, especially with the schools that they've got there.
Yeah.
Schools usually can bring in some pretty good stuff, especially I think Harvard has a really good film theater, is what I think I've heard. But now he's living in Austin, Texas, actually, which also has some really great theaters there, the Alamo Draft House and the Austin Film Society.
That's where they make South by Southwest.
Well, anyway, Erin, I hope our listeners enjoyed this epic podcast and check us out next week. So check us out on the web, www.showmeyourtitles.com.
You can also email us at showmeyourtitles@gmail.com.
And find us on MySpace at myspace.com/showmeyourtitles. Please leave us feedback, write us letters,
Listen to old episodes.
Yes, please listen.
Anyway, go nuts.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye. Yes, I have to pose as a cheerleader in someone's photography project after this.
I didn't need to know that. Oh my god, and we're gonna make a mumblecore movie about it.
Stop it. Okay.